I'm Alex. I'm one of the organizers of the group, and somebody's laughing. On behalf of SIG, I'm honored to present, many of you know him as Phil, Paul Constant. Paul is a long-standing member of the Taft Foundation, which was started by Richard Rose in 1973. He possesses a nuanced understanding of Rose's albigen system. His knowledge stems from 20-plus years of direct experience from the inside out of Rose's teachings, which culminated in realization of his true nature in 2007. Paul's spiritual inklings began in his late teens as a fascination with psychic phenomena such as telepathy and telekinesis. In college, his interest in the non-ordinary evolved to lead him to the works of Ouspensky, Gurdjieff, and Jay Krishnamurti. And finally, via handbill stuff in a book in a Pittsburgh bookstore, to Richard Rose's The Albigen Papers. After devouring all of Rose's material available in print, Paul sensed that something was lacking in his path, and in 1985 wrote to Rose, telling him of his desire to go further. Rose responded cordially, inviting Paul to a summer Chautauqua, which was a gathering for the more serious seekers that they had from time to time, I guess, seasonally. Paul then became a dedicated member of Rose's Taft Foundation. Over the next decade, tried to learn everything he could from Rose until Alzheimer's debilitated him in the 1990s. During this period, Paul became intimately familiar with Rose and the Albigen system, including the concept of directly looking for oneself by backing away from untruth, not looking for truth. He also gained a profound appreciation for working with and serving others, and came to see these as key ingredients on any path of self-inquiry, which he writes about in No Religion is Greater Than Friendship, which you can find on searchwithin.org. I guess I should preface that Paul was a little reclusive and thought he could do it all on his own, and began to see that groups were very important, working with others was very important. After 15 years of work with the TAC group, thinking that his opportunity at realization had come and gone, Paul became increasingly involved in the administrative affairs of the organization as a way to pay it back and help others help themselves. In May of 2007, after what Paul says were 22 years on the path, including 21 years and 9 months of dabbling, he came to the end of seeking. Paul says of his experience, "It was a massive awareness identity problem solved with finality." Paul remains active in TAT and is a frequent speaker at the organization's quarterly gatherings. He also submits content to searchwithin.org and the TAT forum, which is at tatfoundation.org. And you can find most of his writings on either of those sites. Paul is a true denizen, an exemplar of one of the finest Zen-style teachings to emerge on American soil. We're nothing less than blessed to have him here with us today to share the essence of Rose's Albigen system, which is Jacob's Ladder. And please help me welcome Paul. Thank you.
So what I'll do here is start off with a couple of Rose quotes, which will kind of give you the essential Rose and some words I'd like to pick out. Spiritual success, so that's the first quote up there, spiritual success is proportional to energy applied. You have to put your whole self into it. And if you're dynamic, you can come through. A desperate dynamic. The second is, there's a very simple formula for finding this. It's commitment. And lastly, doubt everything except your ability to doubt. So I am certainly grateful to Rose, who more or less provided a roadmap for me, without which I would have pretty much been lost at sea for a lifetime. And likewise, I do have a lot of gratitude for the TAP Foundation as well. Many of you that I know here in SIG are also TAP members and friends. And I probably would have been lost without TAP, having come into the organization in 1985. And today, TAP really keeps me going. It more or less provides a place for people to gather who want to find answers, just like everybody here. So these quotes more or less signify Rose's approach to the spiritual path. You have to commit great action to this. This is not something that's going to drift around to you. You must apply yourself. It's really a desperate dynamic, as Rose used to say, to know what you are with true certainty. And this dynamic doesn't involve beliefs, robes, fees, tithing. You don't get it by being nice to your guru. You'll notice we don't have elegant chairs up here or oversized vase of flowers. It's just the raw truth. So right from the start, I just want to be clear that this was my path. This is something that worked for me, and I took action by going within. And I did it with a lot of determination. I was very determined. And I recognize there are a lot of ways to go about finding your source. But whatever a person uses, when they turn and look within, they're going to see the same essential, unconditioned essence. So, depending on how long you've been a seeker, you might be asking yourself a couple questions about the spiritual path. What do I want out of life? What drives me to find answers, including the ultimate answer? What am I truly? A thinker in a body or mind, a watcher of thoughts, or just awareness? Will anything of me survive death? So you are all asking those questions, right? And Richard Rose assembled a diagram that would help the seeker go within. And he knew that, again, no diagram is all-encompassing. It's not going to capture every part of Rose's system. Yet he did spend most of his entire life after his experience trying to figure out ways to help others to go within. And this is sort of a roadmap to going within and finding out what you really are. And if you follow it upon reaching an endpoint, it will answer all the above questions that I just asked and more. So I will offer a little bit of caveat with this presentation because it's heavy on the heady side. I think we heard a lot of inspirational heart stuff. So the heady people, you can rise to the occasion here. This is going to come from a very rational, logical approach. And I do hope you take away something. It's what I call putting a pebble in your shoe. So this is something that you might walk out of here that will irritate you truly in the weeks or days ahead. And I have the conviction that the feeling side of this is more important. Yet I'm sort of the heady type, so that was my path. However, if you stew about this stuff enough, when your guard is dropped, when your rational, logical side of your path drops away for just a split second, you might get an insight about yourself through intuition. So before I get into this too far, I know we've heard a couple of different words today, and I want to make it real clear about the way consciousness and awareness is going to be used when I go through my presentation, because they often are used interchangeably on the web and in books and some of the speakers we heard today. And there's no de facto standard. I'm just saying this is the way I'm going to use these words when I do my presentation. And I didn't need to recreate something because Bob Servo already did it in his 2004 TAT Forum article, which appropriately enough was titled Going Within. So this is how I'll use it. He says, consciousness is personal and temporary. Awareness is impersonal and timeless. Consciousness is the experience of individuality, and awareness is that which powers it. The experience of individuality is motion on a background of immobility, a whisper that cannot alter or penetrate the silence. Consciousness is a point. Consciousness is the point at which the unmanifested intersects the manifested. Awareness is boundless. Awareness is consciousness without an object, unless you wish to say that awareness is its own object. So that's how I'll use those words today. So Jacob's Ladder comes from Rose's book, Psychology of the Observer. I don't think we have any here today, but this is really the kernel of Rose's system. It's, and in fact, it's probably just a few pages, but what I consider where he really hones in on things. And I think he got the idea of Jacob's ladder from the Old Testament. This would be my speculation. I know I've heard him say that. Where in the Old Testament, Jacob dreamt of a ladder set upon the earth, and the top of it reached into heaven. Of course, we heard from Bruce today, by strange coincidence, he made a movie, the same name, Jacob's Ladder. So you'll note that there are three triangles in this, and it starts with the body, mind, and essence. So the bottom triangle, line AB, it is quite possible to live out your entire existence in that spectrum. And I doubt if anybody here today hasn't thought a little bit more about line AB. And Rose said we could pretty much wallow here for a lifetime, endlessly choosing the positives and the negatives, accepting concepts of good and evil, struggling with fears and desires. Unless we do some introspection, we may never conceive of opportunities to rise above this relative nature of positive and negative. So let me try to simplify this from the start, because some friends, one friend in particular, called this Jacob's Maze. So I'll try to keep things as simple as possible in terms that sort of work for me. Even though Rose was not one to use a lot of elaborate words, he kept things simple as well. As you start to become more aware of your thoughts and feelings, you'll see a drama of voices and appetites that'll play out. For example, everybody here has obsessions and desires. In weighing the repercussions of those desires, we automatically evaluate the impacts. So in weighing those repercussions, for instance, you might, well, I look bad in the eyes of others. That might be something you would weigh. If I pursue those obsessions and desires, will it harm me physically? So this is sort of like an opposition or the voices that are playing out in your head. Or will they get in the way of the other desires that I have? And our struggle with acquiescing to desires might be checked by fears. A voice might tell us to drink alcohol, but then we immediately evaluate if drinking too much will cloud our mind, lead to weight gain, or cause a hangover. It's just a simple play of competing interests. And our daily lives involve a profound pull outward. We heard that a lot this morning today. The body's attention to pleasure and comfort, procreation, nerve titillation through entertainment, food, sex, alcohol, drugs, power and acquisition, fear, pride, and others. This is what the drama is being played out on line AB. We think that everything that happens to us falsely is within our control or of our own doing. We want to add qualities that build our sense of individuality. And another way that you might do this, for example, would be to belittle others, to tear down coworkers and friends, and that's a way of sort of elevating yourself as you push other people down. And of course, Eckhart Tolle in the book The New Earth is very good at describing those games that people play. And alternatively, there's a lot of situations that we just avoid out of fear because it'll diminish the ego. So that's a simple description of why we run away from some things. When you start to watch the mental drama through introspection, you'll reach a vantage point called somatic awareness. Now, Rose has it on here, somatic awareness, but he also used the term umpire quite a bit, so that's how I'll refer to it. And so that's point C. The word somatic is simply defined in a dictionary as relating to or affecting the body, especially as distinguished from the mind or the environment. So somatic awareness simply is awareness of your body. From the umpire, we realize the tenuous relative nature of the line below. So this umpire operates in all of us, but most are sleepily unaware of the programming. Simply put, it is nature's self-preservation faculty. The designer put the umpire in us so that we would survive. It's just as simple as it could be explained. It serves in the best interest of the body, but also has the capacity to grasp higher possibilities. For instance, I got into the spiritual search out of interest in eternal survival. I figured, hey, if I'm going to apply some energy, this is the ultimate self-preservation. I have the possibility of discovering something that is eternal. Fortunately, the umpire makes a lot of mistakes, and that's usually defined in one word, and that's regret. So how do you pop up from this line AB to that vantage point called the umpire? And Rose talked often when he would describe Jacob's Ladder about the Supreme Doctrine, is the name of the book. And Hubert Benoit wrote this in there, part of it was this concept called the conciliatory principle. And often when describing Jacob's Ladder, Rose would talk about his system of tension. His was a system of tension to rise above that, and I'll try to explain that a little bit. And Benoit's idea of these opposites created the tension that gave you the triangulation in order to be able to look down, so to speak, on the things that are playing out in front of you. In life, we often attempt to correct a problem by choosing an opposite thinking pattern or corrective action, but the result is usually temporary. So through this triangulation, we rise above or detach ourselves somewhat from the fear-desire situation in Jacob's Ladder. And this detachment comes about by being honest with yourself, your willingness to face yourself. Or, you know, the tension of life can create enough anxiety or whatever to really pop you up into this higher perspective called the umpire. It's created by tremendous conflict between opposites. And this leap, this isn't a spiritual leap per se at this point. However, we have just climbed our first rung on the ladder, which really is more of a retreat from the error that's on the line AB, that's in your view. We aren't adding ego qualities here. That's not the idea behind Rose's system. We are subtracting error or untruth. In effect, it's no longer you believing me this idea of or concept of an umpire. You become that new perspective. You just know it. It's no longer a belief because you see it. So what can we do as seekers? One thing you can do is use nature's programming more or less against itself. You can reprogram this robot umpire to become a spiritual vector. And again, I mentioned before about the umpire making poor judgments. Unless it incorporates a feeling capacity, you will be hopelessly stuck there in the umpire realm. And in his books, lectures, and conversations, Rose spent a lot of time vigorously attacking that bottom triangle. And in this regard, he really was a masterful psychologist. I've never seen anybody who was able to read people so directly than Richard Rose. And if you really want a taste of that critique of life, read the first four chapters of the Albigen Papers. And still, even if Rose isn't around right now to help us, I think, as I mentioned before, life tends to force our hand eventually. And it just throws enough trauma at us to cause us to want to look within if you are a seeker. So that's sort of an overview of the body realm that is on Jacob's Ladder. The issue at this point is it doesn't see its opposite. And that is the higher intuition on line CD. And this intuition is a little vague. It's something that's always very difficult to describe. It's something that you become more familiar with the more you see it, the more you recognize it, the more you do watching of your thoughts and feelings. So here's a couple of examples that in talking with people, these are friends who have described situations that really don't fit into the construct of the pure rational mind. So you know, and this is an example of somebody's experience, you know who is at the front door at your home immediately before the doorbell rings, even though the visitor was totally unexpected. Another one. Think about someone. A few seconds later, you hear the phone, and that same person is the caller. Now, how would that be explained by something that's completely rational? You're riding in a car with someone, and a thought crosses your mind. This thought is unrelated to previous discussions, yet a few seconds before you attempt to discuss it, the other person chimes in and starts talking about the same topic. I'm sure you've all had some of these experiences that aren't really easily explained by the rational mind, but are getting an insight in, sort of shunting around the umpire. It's an intuition. And here's the last one. Before opening an envelope addressed to you, you are overwhelmed with inexplicable anger. Upon reading the letter inside, you learn that a friend has written an uncharacteristic note of outrage directed at you. So you kind of got a read of what was in that letter before you even opened it. These intuitive thoughts really arrive out of nowhere, seemingly. That's where they come in. They arrive, and you are the witness. But the thing is, the more you trust them, the more accurate they become. And often, this happens to me a lot, I get a hunch about something, and I don't really understand what the reason is for it, but I act on it. And then it proves itself out later. We heard a lot of that this morning from Bruce. And if you want another good perspective on this, Joseph Sidoni's Gates of the Mind is probably the ultimate in a guy who was super intuitive and acted on a lot of his intuition. It's a very good read. So how does this intuition, how does this apply to you on the spiritual path? What's this mean? Some basic examples might be choosing the right book or the right website from thousands. There's so many choices. So how are you going to hone in on what's going to work for you? Likewise, how do you find a teacher that is trustworthy? You know, you're committing your time. In many cases, people are committing money. How do you know which of these people have it? And if you were around Rose, you can just pick up the presence from that man if you were somewhat intuitive. The other thing here is, as a tool, much like a scientist working on a project, puts his or her entire attention on that project. But often you hear about scientists getting the intuition, say when they wake up in the morning and their head is shut down for a little while. So they stop thinking about it, and that's when you get these intuitions. Likewise, with this spiritual path, I think if you surround yourself with friends who are on the path, video, books, really forcing yourself sort of artificially to stimulate your rational mind, you'll get intuitions about yourself if you're looking within. So this intuition, the gist of it is it's helping, it's working the same in tandem with the rational side of the equation. These two are equally starting to help you as a seeker. And in this regard, Rose did encourage many methods as well as a lifestyle, truly, that would help improve the rational and the intuitive faculties of the mind. So going up to the process observer, just like on line AB, we may be caught on line CD until we gain a superior reference point. And as the seeker becomes more determined to watch thought, a dichotomy occurs. You become the watcher. Thoughts and feelings become the observed material, the consciousness. Rose often repeated the phrase, "The view is not the viewer." This watcher is, in Rose's terms, the process observer, which is point D, and seemingly, at this point, the viewer. And Nisargadatta called it the witness. And we have just climbed our second rung on the ladder, which again is more of a retreat from the error on line CD. We're not moving towards something, we're moving within. The mind is now bending in on itself. The mind is studying the mind. This constant attempt to watch the opposites in front of you. This logical reasoning side, which most of us get that pretty clearly, and this intuitive side, which is a little bit squishy for most, causes the seeker to really become more grounded in the observer. You know or become, and again, there's that word, become. You become the process observer based on experience rather than struggling to grasp this vague concept. And I'll take a short tangent here because it was one of Rose's important points about going within. He used the term reverse vector. The seeker is applying energy that builds a vector or intense direction. We are studying what's in the view from an interior vantage point. And this study of the mind applies to everyone, and each person has a unique makeup of ego qualities and a unique way of going within. That's why I can't, and Rose wouldn't do this, he would not prescribe a step-by-step method because everybody's coming at this from a different angle. Yet everybody can watch whatever is unique to your ego quality, you can watch that. The process observer is a portal between the mind and our true essence. It monitors the events and patterns in its view. And we may not even be immediately cognizant of the fact that the mind fools itself. In fact, this really was a key aspect of Rose's teachings. We watch from the perspective of the process observer, and we see ourselves rationalizing energy or opportunity away from the spiritual path. I'm pretty sure everybody in here has made a commitment to do some kind of meditative practice. For instance, I used to walk, and I would say, okay, at 7 o'clock, whenever that time comes, I'm going to take a walk and do some introspection. I'm not the type to sit. And invariably, there would be 10 reasons why I shouldn't meditate that night. And this fooling process, it's really, I should be doing these other things besides sitting down and looking at myself. And indeed, the robot weaves a complex tale to maintain a self-imposed grip on the mind. So looking at this intuition, as you continue to watch the drama in front of you, looking at it will improve your sensitivity, and watching thoughts will quiet down the reasoning side of the equation. We become increasingly in tune with the intuition as it sort of just bubbles up on its own. And as you more or less dampen down the mental activity that will suppress intuition, you get a better glimpse of the feeling side. And I think the idea is here, I don't want you to have some preconceived idea of intuition. Just allow it to arise and watch thought. And don't allow yourself to easily discount these seemingly irrational messages that we're getting from within. The entire mind realm is filled with unsolvable paradoxes, and so it is very limited. What we're doing at this point is applying the mind's maximum capabilities in the spiritual search, yet we heard a lot, the mind does not go with us in the final leg of the journey. Likewise, mystics say that the mind is an illusion. Yet, if you want to test that, step out in front of a speeding car and you'll see how quickly that is real. So that'll end the argument as far as the mind and body being an illusion. You're trying to use the tools at your disposal is what we're doing here. And we must believe in them at that point. In The Psychology of the Observer, Rose often describes the mind's limitations in detail. And the DNA programming that we all have, you know, eons of evolution, our limited sensory apparatus, certainly our sight and our hearing don't follow the full range of spectrum that you see with animals, for instance. We have unique memories. All these things really just don't. We're never going to use the mind to get the maximum answer. We're not going to get a complete accurate picture either. So that's sort of the mind realm of Jacob's Ladder. And up until now, we've been describing individual consciousness. That's that word again. Remember I described the difference between consciousness and awareness. All of this stuff that I just described is the dust storm of the mind. It's the reflected ghost. But watching the mind with the mind over time and with enough effort causes an accidental discovery of an opposite, which is awareness. It's pointing out. much like our situation described earlier, where intuition is pretty intangible relative to the umpire. Likewise, awareness is less tangible compared to the process observer. And here's the key. Awareness is unmanifested, undifferentiated, non-mind. The separation between ego, mind, stuff, and the essential you becomes evident. We become aware of awareness at this point. Yet we are still unable to identify the source of the awareness. Point F is seemingly God in the individual at this point. A conviction remains that the individualistic awareness is an awareness entity that will survive death. From here, there are no railroad tracks, as Rose used to say. The survival ego is torn from us in the final experience. When we hear about the analogy of the drop entering the ocean, and no matter what, I had the conviction that some part of that drop, some molecule, was going to look around in the absolute and say, made it. It's not what happens. This is the false conviction that stops you from becoming the ultimate, capital B becoming. So what Kabir really said, a drop melting into the sea, everyone can see. You can get a picture of that, right, in your mind? But the sea absorbed in a drop, a rare one can follow. Rose encourages us to become. We know awareness, yet it still isn't evident what we become. In reality, nothing of the individual becomes. As Bart says, we're trying to maneuver the mind into a position where it disappears. And when it disappears, when all thoughts and every aspect of the individuality is subtracted, all that remains is real. One thing I do want to mention here is that the lines at the bottom of each of these triangles, they're by no means a black and white proposition. I don't mean to convey that, you know, these points are two opposites and there's nothing in between, when in fact there are very many shades of gray, for instance, between reason and intuition. And in his book, Direct Mind Experience, Rose said that the exact halfway point is where miracles occur. For instance, we can conceive of thought, and you could probably conceive of no thought. But a realized person lives at the point, in fact, you do as well, you just don't realize it. They live at the point where neither occur and yet both occur, which is truly a rather big miracle. So I haven't tested this exercise, but I'll just try something different here. You've all done the Harding exercise. You don't have to do this with me, but it's easy to see things, objects in a room that are not us. It's easy to point to your body and say, that's not me. It's a little hard to convey with my hands, but you could see thoughts and feelings. They're not me. They're in my view. You can get to the point where you see what you're looking out from. Sort of what I get from the Harding exercise. And by the way, if you're stuck here, some of you are, how can you be two awarenesses? There's only one awareness. What's really going on is that we are at the halfway point between everythingness and nothingness. The seeker is broke. The realized person sees both ways. Now, when I'm doing my taxes, I'm out there cursing because I'm doing calculations. But when I'm sitting on my porch at an opportune time looking at the sunrise, I'm back here. So a couple of minutes ago, I said the individualized awareness was seemingly God in the individual. By contrast, the absolute is God in himself. or a better description that I like is God unreflected, a vibrant, boundless nothingness. It is the highest reference point on Jacob's ladder, but paradoxically, it isn't a point at all, but more like a culminating realization, the blast open, a final becoming, a knowing of our source. Afterwards, as we return to our daily affairs, Jacob's ladder more or less collapses. No umpire, no process observer, no awareness watching awareness, just awareness stretching to infinity on one end and reflection on the other. And of course, in truth, there are no ends. And I have to believe the next thing I'm going to say, I don't think Rose would go this far, but so I'll take sort of a risk by conveying some of this information. But I'll offer a caveat in that you simply can't believe me. In fact, I recommend that you doubt me. Rose said, doubt everything. Find out for yourself. You must become the answer to know for yourself. When I say absolute awareness, I might describe it as one, a singularity. But immediately your mind scrambles and says, it assembles an image of something. Your true source has no qualities of thingness. Nothing of what you think you are is part of absolute awareness. Awareness powers you. You don't power awareness. I might describe it as an infinite emptiness, a boundless no thing. But immediately your mind assembles an image of spaceness, a vast universe, and indeed absolute awareness has no boundaries. But all is right here where you sit. In fact, it isn't just here. Absolute awareness is the eye behind you, imploring you to look within. And that eye is eternally saying, be still and know that I am God. So silently answer this question for me. What do you feel when you turn your attention around and look within at this very moment? Feeling sense, that electricity, the sense of a focus shift, the sense of retracting into yourself, that's the same awareness that someone experiences after self-realization. Beforehand, seekers have the conviction that they power that awareness, but after realization, the conviction of individualized quality is forever shattered. The finder no longer looks for his or her essence because we realize we are only essence. The finder understands that awareness is substance of an illusory everythingness. But awareness consists of nothing, right? So Rose said in the 8th chapter of the Elgin Papers, I have used the picture of peering back into the focus of the projector as the final step of becoming one with the absolute. Actually, we go back in one sense, and at the same time, we find that we are back there all the time. And we mentioned this a couple of times, but the theme for the weekend is becoming what is, the long, hard journey from here to here. Do you see the paradox between effort and how simple the answer may be once you become it? So just a couple other aspects of Jacob's ladder. And you'll notice that there is a dashed line coming down from F to D to B. And that's the invisible current. It's the light that flows from the essence to the mind to the body. And our soul is expressed in a manner according to our capacity to understand. The seeker who starts out on the path understands positive and comes to know the umpire, the process observer, and awareness. but it all originates from the same light. And after realization, you'll understand the source of that light flowing downward or outward, however you want to express it. In the presentation I just gave, I used a lot of Rose terminology, but I did do what Rose would do, which was try to avoid a one-size-fits-all prescription for finding your source. And Rose certainly fastidiously avoided dogmas and rituals and other things that don't really lead to finding an answer. We are not adding qualities. This effort to perfect yourself was a trap for me. I figured if I can keep working on this guy in front of you, I can perfect him. That's doomed to failure. So I'm not trying to make you a better ultimate seeker. What I'm trying to do is subtract your errors from along the path. And indeed, it's really a very individual path that we all embark upon. So we can employ this reverse vector away from untruth, the errors of our body and mind faculties. The vector is, as Rose described it, an erosion of ignorance. Thus, Jacob's ladder and Rose's encouragement to go within really do apply to all walks of life, wherever you are. I'll close my presentation by pointing out something that seekers often forget. And Jacob's ladder contains a dark corner there in the lower left part of the diagram. So without knowing your source, death is but an ominous mystery. And that's what this is all about, finding out what happens when the mind and body drop away. Finding out what happens when you die. And perhaps more importantly, and this was important to me, in the final realization, your soul is at rest. You know, if you spend 20 years looking for this and you get your answer, your heart no longer aches. And I know there's a couple people in the room in that situation. So I just walked through Rose's diagram, and again, I hope I've placed a pebble in your shoe that you can take away from today. And we do this, we're not going to get some of these leaps by energetic, one or two energetic bursts. These are, in my experience, a determined long-term commitment. And the desire and the struggle to know may reveal a profound personal discovery for you. And most importantly, never forget your sense of humor. So that's all I had from the formal presentation. I guess if there are any questions, I'd be glad to convey anything that I've covered along my path. That's about the best way I can do it.
Bart? That's actually what I was going to ask you. I mean, in your presentation, it was the abstract look at Jacob's ladder, and you said it was your path. You know, how did you apply it, apply that system or that pattern in the graphic to your own personal path? What's the process of using that, of using Jacob's ladder?
Well, wow, that's a pretty big question. I'm trying to think of the 21 years and 9 months of dabbling. I think I was hungry for knowledge at one point, and so that was a phase in my 20s. So I was reading a lot of books and gathering. I was in the gathering phase of the path. And actually, Rose, he said you had to fatten up your head before you could chop it off. So he said, reading might not appear as action, but it can be action if you start to act on what you're reading. So I can say that was a phase where, leading up to Rose, that I was in the acquisition phase. Then when I encountered him, and this idea that I wasn't going to get that answer with a positive and negative situation. Knowledge was not going to get me there. I think what I, my, in retrospect, what I would say when I first encountered Rose, I was almost on the verge of a devout believer. I mean, I just sensed the guy's power. So when I went there, I had no doubt what he was saying, which is against what he said, doubt everything. But so, in fact, I wrote about that, which was the interesting part of this trip. I went there to hear Rose. So I didn't think, you know, I remember people like talking about other things when I'd go to the TAP meetings, and I thought it was very trivial stuff, and I didn't want anything to do with other people there. It's like, hey, this guy has it, these people don't waste my time. Eventually that changed more or less when he wasn't around. There were a couple guys living on the farm at the time, so we would chop wood. And I'd ask them thousands of questions about their experience with Rose, and I got to be very good friends with these people, and I think they had some things to teach me. Just insights that they had working around Rose long enough. So I started to see the value of friendship, and Rose always said, this is a threefold path. It's the way, the truth, and the life. And life means working with other people that... You know, he had a couple of what he called laws, which were the law of extra proportional returns. If you work with people, you get an added increment. But let's just say two people working together, they don't double their time. He used common terms like the contractor's law. So if you're building a house, you don't only double your time, you get a little added increment. So if you have, for instance, five people working on it, you don't get five increments of work, you get five plus a small increment. Likewise, with the spiritual path, I think it's the same way. And he also had this idea of the law of the ladder. So you would try to work with people who are just coming into the spiritual path. For instance, if you just started out, everybody here knows something. They've done enough introspection to be able to help. And he said when you're working with 10 people below you, you're pulling them up and they're pushing you up. And That was a lesson learned at some point. As Alex said, I realized that I had to stop looking just at my own selfish interest and eventually start turning my direction outward. How can I help others? Somebody put that stuffer in a book, which I encountered. So I figured that's what I'm going to do. You know? So I went out and I used to stuff books. Much to the chagrin of the bookstore owners, but I'd go down the aisle and stuff all these books, thousands of books all over Pennsylvania. Tried to start a group, didn't work out. My path was, as I mentioned, a lot of the dabbling, or I could say it was even a lot of failure along the way. Going back to Jacob's ladder, at some point it was evident to me that where that dichotomy occurred. I couldn't deny that anymore. So as I tried to describe it, the more you watch your mind, the more certain you get that you are not the view. You are the person looking at your thoughts and feelings, and that becomes a more certain prospect. I thought about this. When did I become aware that I was aware? I don't remember. But I was there for a long time. And my tendency for that reason is to look for people that are stuck there. And Rose was very good at the psychology stuff. That's sort of not my forte. But when it comes to this situation, looking, you can see what you're looking out for. You're individually conscious of awareness. That's the point where I feel you got to keep trying until you burn out the mind. That's what happened to me. Even though I sort of floundered a lot of times and coasted, but it was always in the back of my mind, I wanted this answer. And that's what I call the dabbling phase. But it wasn't until the final 3 months where I got dead serious. I realized that I didn't want to die without having the answer. And it was Sean's retreat that he did in February of 2007, I guess. And the interesting part of that was he did the Harding exercise where, many of you have already done this, where you draw yourself as you see yourself. You've heard about some of the Harding exercises. And what you end up drawing is, you know, nothing from here up, so your body. So you end up drawing this body in front of you. So he had, Sean did that with 15 people, I guess, that were there. So I remember we all took our little drawings up and we put them on the floor in front of us and in a circle. So that made sense to me because I, you know, that's what we all see now, right? We see, we're looking out of what we think is ahead. And I can look at everybody and say, well, everybody here is a point of awareness. So when you do that, you put everybody in a circle, their drawings facing each other, that makes sense to me. It was when we turned around, so he said, okay, we're all facing in, I'll turn the back to the center. And it wasn't like an epiphany, it was like, now how could that be? If I was looking at awareness, now awareness is back here and it's one. And you, none of you in this room can repeat that formula, I would say, which is unique to me, but it really got under my skin. And it became desperation. So I picked the one quote, you know, a desperate dynamic to find an answer. And it was a series of emotions, anger, not knowing, fear. So I remember one night, and I told a couple of people this story, where I was laying in bed, and I felt something was happening to myself, and I sort of psyched myself out of the whole thing because I thought I was losing control. And I really got, you know, the complete body reaction, like heavy heartbeat, breathing hard, you know, I was totally afraid of entering this experience. So there was a whole series of things that happened in that 3-month period, and again, this is, you know, there's no railroad tracks beyond this. This is where there's no recipe for laying hold. I mean, that I kept becoming increasingly desperate. In fact, what I would say is, there's a tipping point in this path that you must reach a tipping point where not knowing is more, well, let me say this this way, knowing is more important than not knowing. I mean, you just, it becomes an absolute priority, absolute desperation to know what the answer is. So all of us are kind of caught, and I was there, I was caught in my daily groove. And yes, this was over here, the spiritual work was, quote, important to me. At some point, the whole thing reversed. It was like, I can't go on without not knowing the answer. I didn't want to die without having the final answer. So, what really happened in May of 2007 is I was... TAD has a community building, which is a really good place to have an experience because that building is started in the 70s, I forget which year, but it was a group effort. It's a manifestation of friendship, physical manifestation where people got together to make this place a place for people to gather and do spiritual work. So, with rich irony, there I am in the building, kind of sweeping the floor, and I decide I was going to sit down and meditate. And it's hard for me to go through this, you know, because it's sort of traumatic, and I don't want to cause it to create an impression of the bring me out on the stretcher thing that Rose used to say, but it is still hard because what happens is in this experience, it's the mind death. So I sat down to meditate, like any other time, nothing unique about this. In fact, that third day, I'll sit down for 20 minutes, and if I don't feel like anything's happening, I'll just stop meditating. My meditation was, I would sit down with the conviction I was just going to hold my head in neutral. That was the whole idea. So if my thoughts started to drift, I had the intention to be in neutral, so I would just see the thought and bring and come back to the space that I wanted to be in, which was being aware. So that was my meditative technique. And in this case, the thought would come in, and I would say, "Okay, I see the thought." By the way, that is one of Rose's techniques was, if you can see your head turn away from the thought, you've got a pretty good leg up on what the spiritual path is about. Then you're getting a sense of this awareness. So if you can turn your head away from whatever things are distracting you from the spiritual search, that's a good place to be. In this case, the thoughts became more aggravating or more desperate. So the thought would come in and I would say, "Nope, coming back to center." And I wasn't going to allow my head to drift in this particular case. And then it became, there's been discussion about effortless meditation. This was anything but effortless. This was a fight with death in the end. That's what it was. I didn't know it at the time. So I became more desperate to keep my thoughts on away and just be in the center phase. And it became almost dreamy in some respects, in that it was almost like I was separating from myself in this experience. It was ratcheting up tighter and tighter. It was winding up. There's a lot of tension. And when Rose says there's a system of tension, this didn't make any sense to me until after the fact. That fear impulse that I had, where I thought, I psyched myself up a month or two before this incident, it sort of came back. And I remember thinking, I heard just breathing, and I'm like, "Is that me? This guy's really afraid." But I knew that I had encountered this before, so I just let it drop away. It didn't get me. In fact, the thought was, "No, not this time." And at this point, there was a palpable electricity, which I recognize, because we have, and those of you that have been in a rapport sitting, you can feel. In fact, if you're having a one-on-one conversation, sometimes you can feel this electricity that develops. And this was like I had somehow self-generated this ball of tension or electricity, which was even localized over here. And then in the next instant, then I disappeared. The nothingness flooded in. So there was no part of me there at that point. And I don't know how long that lasted. But then coming out, experience, when you have an experience, things aren't evident right away. I think you have to, your mind and body has to be steeped in that, capital T that, and it starts to permeate you. So I've been doing a lot of reflecting in the last couple of years about this, and I'm convinced there were images put into my head so that I would not forget. And one of the images was the Harding thing, being headless. I had no idea what that guy meant before that, but literally, you are a body. I was a body dropping out of nothingness. The universe was blown, my head blew off and the universe was here. There was just no head. Headlessness is a great description of that particular phase. And then the next phase was, I am Hollow Man. So Margo's description of emptiness, being nothing, a shell, I guess is a clumsy way of describing a shell around what I really am. And what I really am was a feeling of hollowness, because nothingness is just what it describes. And then the last thing that that happened was I put my, you know, I was sitting down during this, and I put my face in my hands, and I knew I did not exist beyond a shadow of a doubt. There was no debate going on. It was just, you know, I was just, I wasn't sad. There was no trauma. It was just, this had happened. Now here's what's interesting about this that might be unique, and I've written about it, so I just tell people honestly, these are the things that happened. When I came out of the experience, you know, Rose wrote this epic three books of the Absolute. Rose is a poet. He was a poet before his experience, and he wrote this epic description. And by the way, if you get to the point where you're at no railroad tracks, that's the kind of stuff you want to read, because it's purely inspirational and meant to tip you over. So the funny part was, I went out on the porch and I thought, hey, you know, I'm going to write something poetic. And it was a colossal flop, because I just put my pen down and said, well, I'm not a poet. I can't write this stuff. I can't write anything. And I started to look at myself and I thought, I'm no different. You know, I expected this grand transformation, even though everybody says it doesn't change you. So then I started to doubt. And this is what I think is unique about it doesn't make any sense when you have an absolute experience of certainty to doubt that. But I went back to the cabin where I was staying, and I read Bart's description and Art's description and Sean's description and Bob Servo's. I'm thinking, this isn't what happened to me. And I'm also thinking, how could it be this simple? So this is the mind spinning back up after being knocked flat. So it's reasserting itself, and only all I can say is only with time, again being steeped in that, there's no denying what's right here. It's Sean's movie, Closer Than Close. It's just a great description of the whole situation after the realization. I don't know if I answered your question about how I applied
it.
Well, you know, one of Rose's things is, what do you know for sure? So you said your mind questioned or doubted, or started to doubt or something. But was there a feeling it wasn't doubt or question? You know, was there a solid, certainty feeling? It wasn't a clear grasp.
I think Luke sent me this article, which I put on Search Within. It was called Doubting Thomas, and it sort of gave me somewhat of an explanation for it, which is, when you're on this path of doubt, my vector was one of doubt. You know, I said I believe Rose, but mostly I disbelieve what other people would tell me. So it's a trajectory of coming into an experience, and you don't just drop all that momentum. So I sort of maybe explained some of it by coming back out of it still doubting. But there was one litmus test, and that's that I just had nothing to search for anymore. When I said before my heart ached, that was gone. So other than that, I couldn't tell any difference between the robot guy in front of you. There was no... Nothing had changed except...
So you might be thinking, doubting stuff, that something changed.
Yes. Something definitely, you know, that I see, that I'm looking out from now, which up until then, I always thought, I could not figure out where the awareness was coming from. That's what became the final go-in that Sean's exercise did for me. I do that Harding exercise and say, Am I the awareness there? Am I the awareness? Where is awareness? I couldn't figure it out anymore. We are all looking out from awareness. It's that simple, that me telling you that doesn't do anybody any good. So I guess this system, for those of you that want to deconstruct your eye, as Margo says, in a systematic manner, Rose's system does that for you. It's tearing down the eye by not doing some kind of artificial action, just by looking at it. It can't help. When the eye's under the scrutiny of the microscope constantly, it starts to weaken. That's what the system is about.
Can you describe in a little more detail the two-way looking at him in the moment you said you couldn't tell, you thought you were you, if things were good. Yet there's still a sense back here. Was it back here? Is that just within the... That?
I could try. Before the experience, I just being aware of awareness implies two awarenesses, and that you understand. I mean, even your mind can understand that's not possible to be two awarenesses. So. What I was trying to convey is everythingness. There's two ways to describe everythingness, and this also is a little confusing. Everythingness could be nothingness, could be absolute awareness. It could be it's boundless nothingness, so it could be everythingness. That's one way. But another way is the illusory everythingness, so it's everything in front of you. That's what I mean by it. The projector, projecting out. Whatever's in the view is everythingness. The nothingness, all I can say is everybody in the room lives at the halfway point between everythingness and nothingness. But the seeker doesn't understand that they are nothingness, that they are looking out from nothingness and can turn around. What the realization does is you can turn around and be it, as opposed to thinking that I was in control of awareness beforehand. I realize that the robot does nothing. It's the shell around the awareness. It's the dust storm. Good picture of a dust storm spinning, and in the center is complete stillness. I know I'm not, I can see by the look on your face I'm not hitting it, but I think it's about the best I can do with words. I don't know if anybody else can elaborate on that. Or...
I wasn't going to elaborate, but I did have a question. So my primary interest right now is, I guess, dissolving the witness. And if I just want to check my understanding from what you said, it sounds like... the method you used was looking from the process observer with a great intention for an extended period of time till the mind burns itself out. Is that accurate, or did you use something extra or different than that?
Yeah, I don't want to give you the impression that I was aware all the time or most hours of the day. It was these intense, just even if it's just a few minutes of the separation, where I can sort of draw back into myself and know that I was the awareness sort of watching the material in front of me. What I would say with burning this, I wrote a little something in that forum, I believe it was a while back, called the mind resistance. Art Tickner's idea of this was the constant looking. There's a resistor between what you really are and what you think you are, and that's the mind. So his idea was apply enough pressure and that resistor burns itself out. Now, there's one thing to this that I didn't mention when I was sort of wrapping up into this experience in the community building, and that's it's fairly important. I prayed for help. And the funny thing is, I was telling my wife this after the fact. I said, I was just praying for someone or something. And she made the comment, you surrendered. And Rose used to say, you can't take the survival ego. It's taken from you. So you can, if your position is you're looking from the process observer, and you continue to do that with enough determination, there is something, grace, something comes along that helps, I don't know. But something will take that conviction away that you have, that you feel like you're going to survive, that you are a drop of water that's going to survive for eternity.
So your intense looking, did it feel like an active attitude or a passive one? That you, when you saw the separation, was it the accepting of what was happening or the active role to maintain it? Does that make any sense?
Yeah, and I'm trying to think of a better way. I'm trying to actually think back. It's not the quality, it's not the quantity of the, I'm going to contradict myself, let's say. It's more like a remembering that, hey, I'm in sleep. I've fallen asleep. I know that I don't want to be in this dream world. So I wake up and say, oh, I just recognize that my thoughts have been floating around doing their own thing, and whoa, that's the dichotomy, your thing. So is that active or passive? I know I put a order into the computer that I'd like to be awake. That's the active part. But I would often, just like anybody else, you know, you're at work, you're in certain circumstances, you're falling asleep. And then I would remember that, hey, I'm asleep and I want to be aware.
When you're saying you're seeing the separation, you're saying you're seeing your thoughts, or like for me, there are periods where I feel like I'm still awareness and I see my body autonomously doing whatever, but it's like freaky to me and scares me, and then like I try to get back inside my body. I don't know if that makes any sense, but there's like a fearful component of it, and I'm wondering if I should try to stay out and let it go, or I don't know if this is making sense.
Well, that's a reaction that you described. I would consider that a very natural reaction. It's a self-preservation reaction to reassert itself. I would add mind and thought and feeling to your whole viewable aspect from the perspective of awareness. That's all in view. But what I wish I sort of had a better way of describing the ego one, ego two game that you get caught up in, that you feel like the awareness makes you superior, in itself becomes an ego. That's not what I'm trying to encourage. I'm trying to just say, be aware of the dichotomy that's occurring in you. When you start reacting to that, and the ego is going to reassert itself in a different way. It's going to sort of trick you into getting back into view.
So when you said you were praying for help, what were you asking for?
I remember very simply saying, someone help me. I remember praying to, as silly as it sounds, even people that have family members that were deceased. I was just grasping. Somebody help me because...
Generically, but not for something specific.
This idea of willingly surrendering, it's impossible. You don't. I don't want anybody to get the impression that you can just say, I've had enough of this search, I'm done. That's not going to happen. That's what I was trying to say. It's taken from you. The survival ego is taken from you.
What were you praying for? You can say, what were you praying for?
Help.
With what?
Just help. Just help. Help me. I'm on the verge of something, and something helped me. And I don't even think it was help me stay here in the dream world. I think it was help me get out of here, get to the other side. So it was.
Thank you.
How was your experience affecting your relationship? How did it affect your life? How do people in your life, do you have a sense of sadness or wish that you sort of didn't make a threat? Just in general, how's it shaped you?
My wife is sentenced to life in the penitentiary. So she's,
what's that?
My wife is sentenced to life in the penitentiary. Let me be real clear about this. There is no, and I used to think about this with the other guys, there's no sense of superiority or I have it and you don't. There is definitely how can I help? What can I do or what can I say to get somebody there? So my relationship is what, the irony is going into the path, it was about me. On this end of the path, it's what can I do? What can be done from the most mundane thing, path logistics and all that stuff to, you know, when I'm discussing things with people, what can be said? Actually, what all these words and things, my conviction is, lead to a feeling. And again, I mentioned that before, there's an electricity that a person feels. And I think all the words leading up to that, if I can accomplish that, that's the best I can do. Do I watch TV and get upset when I read, you know, listen to the news? Yeah. I still don't like what I see. I don't like phonies. There's certain things that I think Rose instilled in all of the students, you know, the phoniness, the people on the take, all the people he ran into that were gurus and out for money or sex or whatever they were out for. So that sort of carries through. I don't like it when I see it on the news. That's why I don't even watch the news anymore. I'm just sort of giving up on it.
And one of the things I remember was saying is he did, but I kind of remember that he had a sense of sadness of knowing that his loved ones, people that he was close to, and his family, that they would never be able to, they would never make the trip, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's something that resonates.
No, I just feel somewhat I subscribe to the acceptance thing, but I just feel like with a lot of conviction things are the way they are for a reason, and you know, for people who don't want to see, that's okay. You know, my wife is very, for instance, very sympathetic and helpful for TAP because she just doesn't have that deep interest. My whole conclusion with this is everybody in the room here is creating their own problem. It's really what it's about. Because you want to find this answer. The other people that aren't here or aren't spiritually inclined are going about their life just the way that it was meant to be. They don't have a problem, or they have a lot of problems, but they don't have this problem. So, and that's something I wrote. It was just with rich irony. We create our own problem, and when we solve it, that's when your heart truly is just fulfilled. I think I answered your question, but not entirely.
Okay, thanks.
What is it that you know now that you didn't know before while you were searching?
Say that last part.
What is this knowledge that you have now that you didn't have before? What is knowledge?
Knowledge is only good to keep you going on the path, but it does. There is no acquisition of knowledge, because knowledge is strictly part of the mind realm. And what you are, is a pure, it's a pure nothingness, so there can be no speck of time or space or knowledge or anything in it. That's what I know, that's what I quote know now, which is implies knowledge, but it's not knowledge. It's just, that's why Rose used the term become. Because you don't become a piece of knowledge, you become what you, your true nature. You become what you really are. And that's sort of the rich paradox of the whole Rose approach. You're applying, you're gathering knowledge, and self-knowledge is the most important. Looking at yourself and being honest with yourself, as opposed to reading books and trying to... I am the furthest from scholarly. I mean, these guys talk about these teachers. I just don't know anything much about them. I just sort of quit reading. I read a little bit now, but just to get a new appreciation for it. So I don't want to discourage people from reading, because it is a form of action. But if you're reading to improve your spiritual ego or your knowledge base, that's not going to get you anywhere. But if you're doing it to learn more about yourself, what traps you or what your your blocks are, that's valuable knowledge. So what was the first part of your question? What do I see?
What do you know now that you didn't know before? What changed for you? I mean, you talked about the heart, so I was just focusing more about what type of assurance of existence do you have now? I mean, is this assurance or this realization that you have, will it transcend that?
Yes. Yes, I'm right now. I know that I'm looking out from death, because death is no mind, no body. But it's not the void. It's not oblivion. I'll just say it's not oblivion. People do use the term void because it's void of all thought and feeling. So this idea of the trauma... There's another mystery about this. Rose was very emphatic about saying we don't all go to the same place after we die, which implies that there are dimensions. But what I'm looking out from now is dimensionless, spaceless, timeless. So that's, if you want to, I guess there was the other litmus test. One was quenched my desire or the heartache for it, but also it does. I know that I'm looking out from death now, so that I got my answer. I knew that I didn't want to die before knowing what I was. And ironically, there's the death. What you really are is just an alive awareness, a vibrant awareness that can't die. Now, I don't know, I can't assert Rose's idea of do we all go to the same place. It's sort of, I think he used to say that he used to use the description, if somebody believed in Jesus Christ, for instance, and if they died and found themselves somewhere that had no relation to where they thought they would be, he felt that that would be just, like a brutality or something that, like a hell. So his conviction was when that person died, they would see Jesus. Jesus would pull them over to the other side. So there was a sense of this mysterious part about, when we don't all go to the same place. Maybe it's the level of what your capacity is once you get to the other side. But when you reach this maximum capacity, you realize there is no dimension, nowhere to go, because it's eternal space, spaceless.
Thank you, Phil.